The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next hour I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated April 11/April 18, 2022, bordered in red as usual on the front cover with a narrow inner border of white. Time is itself in large block lettering superimposed in white upon a black background. It features a portrait of a man wearing a blue shirt with the top button open. We see only his head and his collar. He has short, dark hair with just a bit of gray in it. He is Caucasian with, I would say, freckles, because this is a real close-up and shows even the shadow of a dark beard. He has dark eyes, and I am not sure if they're brown or gray or green or a combination. He's looking askance from the camera and is neither smiling nor not smiling. He's just about to smile or say something. The caption reads, "Amazon launches into a new era." CEO Andy Jassy, J-A-S-S-Y, is apparently the picture of the person on the cover. Moving now into our first article, which is short. It is entitled, "The Rear Front Line." Women in Ukraine are mobilizing beyond the battlefield to defend their country. By Amy Ferris Rotman, Lviv. There's a photo here. It's a sewing room. It's a well-lit sewing room with beige walls, windows, fluorescent lights on the ceiling, and 1, 2, 3, 4 tables are shown, each of which is equipped with what appears to be a commercial sewing machine with various spools of thread atop it, and they're commercial size spools of thread. A woman is operating each of the sewing machines, and to either side of the four women seated at the machines is a woman standing as if she's inspecting a garment or some other aspect of the manufacturing process. A couple of tape measures are slung over some rods next to the sewing machines, and there are a lot of fabrics apparently stockpiled on shelves off to the side. The caption reads, "Volunteers take over a factory in Lviv to sew flak jackets for Ukrainian troops March 8. Oh, by the way, there's a planter with a lot of green growing in it on the windowsill. On a chilly evening in mid-March, Miroslava Borokovska is clearing out the trunk of her car. The 38-year-old Ukrainian travel agent has come to the main railway station in Lviv on a mission. Since Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine February 24, the city near the Polish border has become a sanctuary for hundreds of thousands fleeing Ukrainians. Budakovska has made about 20 trips a night to the station for weeks, ferrying women and children to shelters. I go back and forth till the sun comes up, then I go to bed. When the invasion began, she was in nearby Poland, receiving treatment for skin cancer. Ignoring medical advice to rest, she raced back to Ukraine to help. I'm now fighting two wars, with cancer and with Russia, she says, arranging soft toys on her car's back seat for children to play with when they arrive. Unlike men of fighting age who are barred from leaving the country, women have been able to flee to safety. Even so, women still make up around 15% of Ukraine's army, meaning there are around 30,000 women currently facing Russia on the battlefield. But that number does not reflect the full scope of their fight. The businesswoman storing medical supplies beside a fridge of freshly piped cakes in her patisserie. The wedding dressmakers switching out lace for camouflage. The school teacher running a hotline, searching for relatives in besieged Mariupol. Together, they pose an unanticipated challenge to President Vladimir Putin, becoming the other line of defense in a war where solidarity and high morale appear to be thwarting Russia's plans for a swift victory. He did not take us into account, says Lilia Shich, a pulmonologist who treats internally displaced women and children free of charge in Lviv. The city has remained relatively safe but is jittery with war preparations. Government offices have been sandbagged, cultural treasures stored away, techno clubs converted into temporary refuges, and soup kitchens. Art museums and restaurants are abuzz with women and men tapping at laptops, sorting through lists of tens of thousands of displaced Ukrainians needing accommodation and transport. Everyone is a volunteer, and most of them are women. The scenes are reminiscent of World War II in the U.S. and Europe, including the Soviet Union, when women were instrumental to the war effort, working in weapons factories and taking up clerical jobs to free men to fight. Locals say Ukrainian fighters are able to draw motivation from nationwide efforts. For Russian soldiers who are far from home and whose relatives are out of harm's way in Russia, the war can feel impersonal, argues seamstress Natalia Domashovitz. Every Ukrainian family is involved, and that's why we are strong. And that is also why we will win, she says, hemming a grenade vest. Around the country, women have also been trying to hold the Putin regime to account. A collective called Datalian, made up of some 120 female volunteers, are using their smartphones to capture the atrocities committed by Russian soldiers, from executions to bombings of air raid shelters. Since its inception, February 27, Datalian has verified around 1,500 videos. I always knew how strong Ukrainian women were, its founder says, but this has now been confirmed 1,000 times over. For the record, we have here 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 very short items. I was out of line and I was wrong, says Will Smith in an Instagram post March 28, apologizing for slapping presenter Chris Rock, who made a joke about the appearance of Smith's wife, Jada Pinkett Smith, at the Oscar ceremony March 27. There was no doubt to me my dogs sitting unprotected in these conditions could lead to death, stated by Mia Porsiud, one of three mushers demoted in the Iditarod Trail sled dog race for having sheltered their dogs during a windstorm, the AP reported March 27. I cannot be confident it is imminent, said Robert Malley, U.S. Special Envoy for Iran, on the prospect that world powers would reach a nuclear deal with Iran, stated March 27. $850 million, the largest ever taxpayer contribution for a pro football facility, announced March 28 as part of a deal to help the Buffalo Bills build a $1.4 billion stadium. I just no longer felt comfortable with the programming at Fox, said Chris Wallace in an interview with the New York Times published March 27 on his decision to leave the network. 47,000, the number of grocery store workers in California, who voted from March 21 onward to authorize their union to call a strike. Put simply, people cannot afford food of the quality or quantity they need, said Lama Faki, Middle East and North Africa director at Human Rights Watch, on how trade disruptions exacerbated by the war in Ukraine are affecting people in the region. 460, the width in square miles of a massive ice shelf that collapsed in East Antarctica, in an area previously thought to be stable in the face of climate change, scientists said, March 25. Courting victory, a large photo here, well, not large, about a third of a page, which is large as far as photos go in time. Lots of blue and lots of white visible here, with blue and white throughout the spectators in the tall stands. Courting victory, North Carolina's Armando Bacot goes up for a dunk during the Elite Eight round of March Madness in Philadelphia, March 27. UNC's victory knocked fan favorite underdog St. Peter's out of the NCAA tournament, but not before St. Peter's made history by being the first ever number 15 seed to advance that far. I got a bunch of guys that just play basketball and have fun, St. Peter's coach Shaheen Holloway said in an interview. That's all we do. The Bulletin, Caribbean Tour raises questions on monarchy's role, by Eloise Berry. Protests disrupted a tour of former British colonies in the Caribbean by the Duke and Duchess of Cambridge, Prince William, and Kate Middleton. The tour began March 19 amid growing calls to cut formal ties with the Queen and a reckoning with the region's colonial past that includes calls for slavery reparations. Queen Elizabeth II is monarch of 14 countries outside the UK, including Canada, Australia, Papua New Guinea, that are all known as the Commonwealth realms. Officially, the trip was meant to commemorate Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee, celebrating her 70 years on the throne. But many observers say the trip was to persuade Belize, Jamaica, and the Bahamas to keep the Queen as head of state. On the second stop of their trip, Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness told the royals, "We intend to attain in short order our true ambitions as an independent, developed, prosperous country." In November, Barbados became the first country to remove the Queen as head of state since Mauritius in 1992. Dame Sandra Mason, the island's Governor General since 2018, was named President-elect of the nation. "The time has come to fully leave our colonial past behind," she said. Debates about abolishing the monarchy have rumbled on for decades in other Commonwealth realms. Although the Queen's role in Commonwealth realms is largely symbolic, attitudes toward the royal family are varied and complex. Some believe keeping the Queen as head of state undermines independence and only serves to perpetuate colonial subservience. Imagine being given independence and then to be told, as an adult nation, the Queen still had a stake in Jamaica, and the island is not really free. It is still an infant colony, explains Jamaican-born British writer and academic Velma McClymont. News ticker. Three short articles on this page. Oligarch Abramovich poisoned. Russian oligarch Roman Abramovich and two others reportedly suffered symptoms consistent with poisoning after attending peace talks between Russia and Ukraine in March. The report said all recovered, and Russia denied any links to the incident. Fines for UK lockdown parties. London's Metropolitan Police said it had issued 20 fines for individuals for breaking restrictions during parties at 10 Downing Street, Prime Minister Boris Johnson's residence during COVID-19 lockdowns from 2020 to 2021. The police did not name those fined. Downing Street said Johnson was not among them. Russian newspaper stops its run. Novaya Gazeta, the last remaining major independent newspaper in Russia, suspended operations March 28. The newspaper, headed by 2021 Nobel laureate Dmitry Muratov, cited warnings from the government linked to a new law criminalizing fake news about the Ukraine conflict. Good question. How many planets have been found, and how many more are out there? By Jeffrey Kluger. Time was, there were only 9 known planets in the entire universe, the gaggle of worlds that orbit our sun. That number was reduced to 8 in 2006 when the International Astronomical Union busted Pluto down to a dwarf planet. But even before Pluto was pink-slipped, the planetary census far deeper in space began to grow with the discovery in 1992 of a planet orbiting a rapidly spinning pulsar, and later in 1995 of a Jupiter-like planet orbiting a sun-like star. Since then, the planetary population has exploded, and as NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory recently reported, the official total of known worlds beyond our own has now topped 5,000. The majority of the discoveries were made by the Kepler Space Telescope. Launched in 2009, it hunted for planets using the so-called transit method, looking for the slight dimming in light that occurs when an orbiting planet briefly blocks the light from the star. The dimming is fantastically subtle. Former Kepler mission director Natalie Batalla described it to Time as the equivalent of removing a single light bulb from a board of 10,000 of them. And Kepler studied only a tiny portion of the sky, encompassing just 150,000 stars. Still, in the 11 years it operated, it confirmed the existence of 2,709 exoplanets, and has returned data still being studied about a possible 2,057 more. The newer Transiting Exoplanet Survey satellite, TESS, launched in 2018, also uses the transit method, but is equipped with multiple telescopic eyes, allowing it to scan the entire bowl of the sky. In just the short time it's been operating, it's confirmed the existence of 203 more exoplanets and has spotted another possible 5,459 that astronomers are now investigating. The transit method is not the only way to go looking for exoplanets. Other telescopes, both space-based and Earth-based, use what is known as the radial velocity method. They study a star looking for the slight wobble caused by the gravity of a planet or multiple planets tugging on it as they orbit. The most celebrated multi-planet system to date is located just 39 light-years from Earth, where 7 planets orbit the red dwarf known as TRAPPIST-1. The planets that have been discovered so far range in size and composition. There are so-called hot Jupiters, which, as their name suggests, are gaseous worlds that orbit close to the fires of their parent planet. Others are smaller gas worlds, similar in size to Neptune. Still others, the most promising ones, are compact, rocky planets like Earth, some orbiting in the habitable zone of their star, a place where temperatures are not too hot and not too cold for water, the sine qua non of life as we know it, to exist in a liquid state. The mere fact astronomers find planets pretty much everywhere they look has led them to conclude virtually every star in the universe is orbited by at least one planet, making for trillions upon trillions of potential worlds. Each one of them is a brand new planet, said NASA astronomer Jesse Christensen in a statement. I get excited about every one because we don't know anything about them. Here are a few more news tickers. Trump likely committed crimes, judge. A federal judge, RF, ruled, I think the F is redundant, ruled March 28, former President Donald Trump more likely than not committed felonies in his efforts to overturn the 2020 election. U.S. District Judge David Carter made the judgment while ordering the release of emails from Trump ally John Eastman in a civil case. DeSantis signs Don't Say Gay bill into law. March 28, Florida's Republican Governor Ron DeSantis signed legislation banning classroom instruction about sexual orientation or gender identity in kindergarten through third grade, or in a manner that is not age appropriate, which critics say could extend to higher grade levels. The law, which opponents dubbed the Don't Say Gay bill, goes into effect July 1. FDA approves 50-plus COVID-19 booster. March 29, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized a fourth dose of Pfizer or Moderna vaccine to people ages 50 and up, at least 4 months after their previous booster. The move comes amid a wave of infections in Europe and the spread of the Omicron subvariant known as BA.2. This is from the Milestones page. Died Taylor Hawkins, Foo Fighter drummer, March 25 at 50. Died Stephen Wilhite, creator of the GIF animated image, March 14 at 74. Broken temperature records in Antarctica. As amid rapid climate change, a high of 11.3 degrees Fahrenheit was hit March 18, 70 degrees Fahrenheit warmer than normal. Stepping away, Bruce Willis, from acting after being diagnosed with aphasia, which his family revealed on social media March 30. Barred employees without beards from working for the Afghan government by the Taliban from March 29, sources told Reuters. Awarded $14 million to protesters injured in George Floyd demonstrations after a verdict March 25 that police used excessive force. Won Best Picture at the Oscars by Coda, about the hearing daughter of a deaf family, the first streaming film to snag the award. And one more prominent article about someone who died, Madeleine Albright, a barrier breaker. Katie Kelly writes this column, and there is a portrait here of Madeleine Albright. Black background, she is wearing a bright deep navy jacket or something. We see this is mainly a headshot. She has an interesting Art Deco pin, which looks like an old hood ornament from a Pontiac, maybe. But it's very sleek and metallic and Art Deco looking. She's wearing a necklace. It appears to be in yellow gold as well as earrings. Her hair is short and pulled back. Well, it might be long, but it's pulled back and it appears to be fairly short around her face. It's a reddish gold color. She's looking off to her left at the camera with light blue-green eyes, and she does have a ruby-colored lip rouge. Madeleine Albright, the trailblazing public servant who immigrated to the United States as a refugee and went on to become the first woman to ever serve as U.S. Secretary of State, died March 23 of cancer. She was 84. Albright, who was born Marie Jana Korbelova in Prague in 1937, and whose family fled both Nazis and communists, became an expert on foreign policy during a career that eventually brought her around the world as the highest-ranking woman in U.S. government history at that time. Those who worked with Albright and chronicled her career remember her as an effective communicator who explained complex international issues with clarity, a gatherer of people who believed in fostering bipartisanship through conversation, a no-nonsense negotiator who often employed her eclectic pin collection to send diplomatic messages, and a feminist icon whose voice on global affairs long outlasted her years of public service. Albright was a champion of women's rights internationally and a vocal advocate for democratic women in U.S. politics, famously warning that there is a special place in hell for women who do not help other women, a motto born out of the scrutiny she faced from women in her own life when she pursued graduate school while her children were still young. In 1993, Albright, already an influential voice in the Democratic Party, was appointed U.S. Ambassador to the U.N. by President Bill Clinton, and he was urged 3 years later to appoint her as Secretary of State after Warren Christopher stepped down. Former Maryland Senator Barbara Mikulski was among those calling for her appointment and said Albright knew both sides of the aisle, both sides of the dome, that they really admired her. They admired her brilliance. They admired her feistiness. They admired her ability to communicate. Albright was unanimously confirmed by the Senate January 22, 1997, and served in the role until 2001. As Secretary of State, she promoted the expansion of NATO, led the call for military intervention in Kosovo, negotiated with North Korean leader Kim Jong-il about nuclear weapons, and promoted the global advancement of women. But also, Albright faced criticism for her response to some key foreign policy issues. Her recommendation as UN ambassador to withdraw peacekeeping forces from Rwanda amid a crisis that turned into a genocide has drawn intense scrutiny. She's described the decision as her greatest regret. After leaving office, Albright remained an engaged voice in policy debates until her death. It had not occurred to me, frankly, that I would ever be in a position to break a glass ceiling, particularly a woman who is married and the mother of twins, she told Time in 2016, but the turning point did come. The brief news from the world. Macron positions himself as statesman of Europe by Vivienne Walt Paris. For a leader given to dramatic flourishes, French President Emmanuel Macron announced his run for re-election with uncharacteristic humility. In a simple letter published in French newspapers in early March, he addressed his citizens, "I am seeking your trust again." So began an odd campaign, if you can call it that. Macron's 11 rivals in the first-round vote on April 10 spent months sniping while Macron glided above the fray. The runoff, April 24, looks likely to be a rematch of 2017 with Macron against the far-right Marine Le Pen, and he seems set to hand her another defeat. "It seems over before it's even begun," Le Monde declared of the Phantom campaign. His rocket ride to power 5 years ago stunned Europe and crushed France's mainstream Republican and Socialist parties. This time around, he's playing the president, not the candidate. Macron, 44, has appeared to watch the election from afar, too busy with crises like the war in Ukraine to focus on politics. He was even photographed unshaven in his ornate office in jeans and a hoodie, widely seen as a nod to Ukraine's president, Volodymyr Zelensky, whose viral appearances get plenty of French airtime. While Macron's popularity is up since Russia's invasion began, his far-right rivals have scrambled to explain their long support for Russian President Vladimir Putin. Le Pen, 53, pulped more than a million pamphlets showing her shaking Putin's hand. By contrast, Macron, who has the luck of France being the EU's current rotating president, has assailed Putin and used his frequent talks with the Russian leader to cement his stature as statesman. That's also helped bolster his key argument: Europe needs to reduce its dependence on Washington and cut its own path to power. But Macron's wartime role can take him only so far. Even as voters look set to give him another term, many can barely conceal their distaste for a man they see as a know-it-all, disconnected from hardship. After he raised fuel prices in 2018, hundreds of thousands of yellow vest activists protested for months. Emmanuel Rivière, head of international polling for Kantar Public in Paris, believes the pandemic saved Macron. The French leader committed billions of euros to supporting businesses and rolled out a mammoth vaccine program. France bounced back and now has its lowest unemployment rate in years. But tough times could be coming. There's a high level of detestation of Macron, which is unprecedented in France, says Marc Lazar, professor of political history at Sciences Po University in Paris. Those feelings could boil over as prices rise and a 171 billion euro deficit begins affecting daily lives. Macron quietly announced March 10 he intended to raise the public pension age from 62 to 65. Voters say inflation is their top concern, and many struggle to make ends meet. About 30% of voters intend to pick far-right names on April 10, while far-left Jean-Luc Mélenchon grabs 14% for an outside shot at the runoff. All that portends trouble. You have a big risk of a new social revolt, Lazar says. Observers warn Macron's phantom campaign could come back to haunt him. The anger among the French has not been expressed in this election, says Antoine Pristiel, a public opinion expert at the Fondation Jean Jaurès in Paris. Instead, he says it will be expressed in the street in his next 5 years in office. The Risk Report by Ian Bremmer, China's deepening showdown with COVID-19. If Vladimir Putin hasn't ordered an invasion of Ukraine, that's hadn't ordered an invasion of Ukraine, the headline-making story right now would be the intensifying war between China and COVID-19. In Shanghai, population around 26 million, state officials announced March 27 the eastern half of the city would be locked down till April 1 for mass COVID-19 testing. When that's accomplished, the western half will be locked down till April 5. Health officials conduct tests across shutdown areas, and an infected resident can be forced into a quarantine facility. Tens of millions in Jilin province and the tech hub city of Shenzhen, population 17.5 million, have already been locked down. But the closure of Shanghai, the commercial and financial heart of the world's second largest economy, is the most drastic move yet taken as part of the zero COVID policy, a plan designed to keep COVID-19 infection numbers as close to zero as possible. The plan has been successful in limiting the spread of the virus. China's leaders have reported fewer than 5,000 deaths over the course of the pandemic, as the death toll in the U.S. nears 1 million. Even if China's official numbers are suspect, and they are, the loss of life has surely been proportionally much closer to levels reported in Australia, New Zealand, and Singapore, which until recently have also exercised ultra-strict COVID control policies. But zero COVID exacts a heavy economic toll. China's economic growth has been slowing for years as rising wages reduce incentives for foreign companies to use China as a manufacturing hub, and as large-scale state investment in infrastructure and real estate development creates an oversupply of both. The pandemic and the war in Ukraine raise the cost that everyone, including China, must pay to import fuel, food, and other commodities. Shutting down half of Shanghai, even for a few days, will add to the burden. This reality has forced an easing of some zero COVID rules. Instead of being forced into overwhelmed hospitals, infected people with mild symptoms can now report to local quarantine facilities. The length of some quarantines has been reduced, but despite the economic damage already done, the massive lockdown in Shanghai demonstrates China's government is not ready to change course. All this trouble comes at a politically sensitive moment. This fall, a Communist Party Congress is expected to ratify a landmark decision to award Xi Jinping a third term as China's leader. Since the pandemic erupted, Xi has tried to deflect blame for COVID-19's origins and for the early censorship that allowed the virus to go global. He has made his case for the superiority of China's system by pointing to the political turmoil, economic fallout, and higher death toll in America and Europe. But the Omicron variant has made life in China far more complicated. It's hit the country hard because so few Chinese have been either infected with COVID-19 or jabbed with the more effective vaccines found in the U.S. and Europe. Xi can hope new treatments and the development of a domestically made mRNA vaccine will come sooner rather than later. But the risk is rising that COVID-19's disruption of Chinese life will get worse before it gets better, and that Xi will have to carefully manage the economic and political fallout to keep his long-term consolidation of political control on track. Society. Rethinking the Office for Moms, by Reshma Sojani, author of Pay Up, The Future of Women and Work and Why It's Different Than You Think. Nobody wants to go back to the office quite like white dudes. This does not mean all white dudes are pushing this return, or that everyone in this camp is white or a dude, but just over 30% of white men want to go back full-time, compared with around 22% of women, black and white, and 16% of black men. For working moms especially, remote work has brought a new level of flexibility and self-determination. And studies show flexible work can increase our sense of belonging, particularly for black workers. But for 2 years, the office advocates have put us through the same, when can we get back? Conversation, ignoring the more important one. Is there an office that working moms would be excited to go to? If so, why aren't men fighting for it? In a word, comfort. The office was designed for men who made the money, while their wives took care of the home and family. Not only was the temperature set low to optimize for the warmth of their suits, the standard of professionalism was based on white male sociality. It is no wonder I felt relieved to work remote early in the pandemic. Still, with 2 kids at home, I soon began to understand the urge to go back, but not to the office as we know it. We need a new kind of workplace built with moms in mind, one that gives workers control over their time, lets them work from home as needed, offers child care support and addresses biases. Reimagining the workplace is not about the end of comfort. If all goes well, for many, it will be the beginning. This is the View essay, subtitled Nation, How Big Tech Weaponizes Shame, by Kathy with a C, O'Neill. O'Neill is the author of The Shame Machine, Who Profits in the New Age of Humiliation. Shame is a visceral, instinctual response. We react violently to shaming by others, either by feeling shame or by feeling outraged at the attempt. This human hardwiring, which historically salvaged our reputations and preserved our lives, is being hijacked and perverted by the big tech companies for profit. In the process, we're needlessly pitted against one another. It does not have to be like this. What I have learned, in part from very personal experience, is that shame comes in a number of forms, and the better we understand it, the better we can fight back. Whereas shame is primarily a useful social mechanism that coerces its target into conforming with a shared norm, the kind of shaming that often goes viral on social media is a punching down type of shame, where the target cannot choose to conform, even if they tried. That obese woman who fell over in her scooter at Walmart, viral. That overdose victim, shamed. Shame's secondary goal is arguably more effective on social media, namely, to broadcast the norm for everyone to see. When we see yet another phone video of the outrageous public Karen situation, it can conceivably be seen as a learning situation for everyone else. But what exactly are we learning? The ensuing viral shame is swift and overly simplistic, often leaving little context or right to due process. When we do hear further from the target, the shame tends to have backfired, leaving the alleged Karen defiant, finding community with equally defiant others. Finally, the underlying societal problem exposed by a Karen episode is left unaddressed, that white women hold outsized power over others, especially black men, because of a historical bias in policing. As poorly as shame plays out, it is exactly how the big tech companies have designed it. I should know. I used to work as a data scientist in the world of online ads. I would decide who deserved an opportunity and who did not, based on who had spent money in the past and who had not. Most online algorithms quantify and profile you, putting a number on how much you're worth, whether it's to sell you a luxury item or to prey upon you if they deem you vulnerable to gambling, predatory loans, or cryptocurrencies. In turn, the advertisers who find you figure out your weaknesses and deftly exploit them. When I realized I was helping build a terrible system, I got out. For social media, the data scientists are interested in only one thing: sustained attention. That is why online we are made to feel so very comfortable, surrounded by like-minded friends, perhaps thousands of them. It is big enough to feel like we're in society, but of course it is actually quite small, a minute corner of the world. The ways we disagree with others outside our group are filtered straight to us via algorithms, and the ways we agree with one another are likewise filtered away from us, making them essentially invisible. That automated boosting of shame-based outrage triggers us, and we get habituated to performing acts of virtue signaling. We jump on the shame train to get our tiny little dopamine boosts for being outraged and for our righteousness. That we get accolades from our inner circle only serves to convince us once again that we are in the right and people outside our circles are living in sick cults. This turns what should be a socially cohesive act into a mere performance as we get stuck for hours on the platforms, tearing each other down for the sake of increasing the profits of big tech. What is particularly tragic about all of this is that the shame does not work at all. It is inherently misdirected. For shame to work, in the sense of persuading someone to behave, we first need to share norms and even a sense of trust. And second, the target of the shame needs to have the expectation that their better behavior will be noticed. Those preconditions are rarely met online. We have had differences of opinion for a long time. That is nothing new. By pitting us against one another in these endless shame spirals, big tech has successfully prevented us from building solidarity. The first step is for us to critically observe their manipulations and call them what they are, shame machines. The D.C. Brief by Philip Elliott, Washington correspondent. It is entirely reasonable that most of Washington missed the development. After all, it's been a busy few weeks with a Supreme Court nomination, a war in Europe, and a lingering pandemic. But the March 21 breakdown in peace talks between Russia and Japan may demand D.C.'s attention if not properly managed. You see, the Soviet Union and Japan never actually signed a peace treaty after World War II ended in 1945, much like how the U.S. still technically remains at war with North Korea, even though active fighting ended in 1953. Moscow, at the moment, lacks the capacity to credibly fight a second front, but that does not mean the geopolitical trap is not one that has D.C. worried. Because technically, post-World War II Japan is not allowed to have a military and nominally relies on foreign might. The West could be drawn to Tokyo's defense if Moscow gets antsy for a distraction from its fight in Ukraine, which means an errant Russian attack on Japan could force the U.S. into a live-fire war with U.S. forces in play. Russia repositioning its Pacific fleet is raising worries about the eventual need for U.S. involvement. Climate is Everything by Justin Warland, senior correspondent. Across the globe, politicians are fuming about record-high gas prices and proposing a range of policy mechanisms to bring down costs, including cutting gas taxes and offering drivers rebates. These policies make political sense as everyday people suffer at the pump, but they help mask the true cost a gallon of gas imposes on society, from the risk of traffic accidents to the contribution to climate change. Calculating the damage is a fraught process, and economists do not necessarily agree about all the variables. But one thing is definitely true. Driving costs society much more than you are paying to do it. These unpaid costs to society, what economists call externalities, are fairly easy to understand. Cars cause gridlock, which reduces productivity. Accidents kill tens of thousands in the U.S. each year. Cars generate air pollution and, as a result, contribute to health ailments like asthma and heart disease. Importantly, cars also emit carbon dioxide and contribute to global climate change. The average U.S. passenger vehicle emits 4.6 metric tons of carbon dioxide annually, and transportation is responsible for nearly 30% of the country's greenhouse gas emissions. To find a precise estimate of the externalities associated with driving, I turned to a 2007 paper from Resources for the Future. The research group found, if you add up all the mileage-related externalities, namely congestion, accidents, and local air pollution, the cost comes to a whopping $2.10 per gallon. Climate change contributes another 72 cents per gallon if you look at the group's estimates that are in line with current understanding of the effects of emissions. Add the two up and it's clear the cost of the externalities can total $3 per gallon. Of course, no politician is proposing a gas tax to account for all the damage driving causes. On average, state taxes add 31 cents to the cost of a gallon of gas, while federal taxes add another 18.4 cents, according to federal data. Nonetheless, the numbers offer an important dose of reality. Without a radical policy change, drivers are getting a free ride. From art, the artist El Cid takes calligraphy to the streets by Nicola Chilton, and this will be abbreviated. The Dubai-based artist El Cid, that's E-L space S-E-E-D, who draws upon Arabic calligraphy's looping and curved shapes to create mesmerizing and often massive installations of wood, metal, glass, and more, believes words are powerful, and that is why he incorporates them into his work. One of his most recent works, for example, took the form of a giant, colorful installation of painted fabric across the rooftops of the Nepali village of Giranchaur, which was leveled by an earthquake back in 2015 and rebuilt mostly by local women. "There's nothing between us, nothing at all," read the Arabic script on the piece, which quoted Nepali poet and activist Yogmaya Nupane, "Your eyes have tears just like my own." 7 years after opening his Dubai studio, El Cid, whose projects have appeared everywhere from the favelas of Rio de Janeiro to the Korean Demilitarized Zone, is at the forefront of that city's vibrant and growing arts community. What I like about this place is the diversity and seeing people from different communities, ethnicities, and religions being able to practice and live on their own terms, but in respect of everybody else, he says. His public works can be spotted throughout the city. What he considers his most iconic piece in Dubai, Declaration, is a bright pink sculpture outside the Dubai Opera, ripe for public engagement. "I invite people to climb on the structure, to walk through it, under it," says the artist. Born 40 years ago in France to Tunisian parents, El Cid, a pseudonym referencing the 17th century French tragicomedy Le Cid, L-E space C-I-D, itself based on an Arabic word, Sayyid, S-A-Y-Y-I-D, meaning master, painted his first wall in a Parisian suburb as a teenager in 1998. "A woman saw me from a balcony and was screaming like crazy, saying, 'I'm going to call your mom right now.' I was looking at her like, 'What's wrong?' he says. 'The wall is gray. I bought the paint. I painted an art piece on the wall. I am making the neighborhood more beautiful.'" His professional career did not begin till a decade later when, while working as a business consultant in Montreal, he painted his first piece of Arabic calligraphy as public art. "I felt something was missing from my life. I was dying inside, and I just wanted to paint," he says. "I had this impression something had been in me for years, and it was just waiting for me to express it," he says. 2 years later, on the day before his daughter, now 11, was born, El Cid quit his day job to dedicate himself to art full-time. Beginning in 2013, El-Seed took up a one-year residency at Dubai's Tashkeel Contemporary Art and Design Center at the invitation of founder and director Sheikh Al-Latifa bint Maktoum bin Rashid Al-Maktoum, a member of Dubai's ruling family. It was apparent he would make work with an impact, says Sheikh Al-Latifa. Key to El-Seed's approach, says Sheikh Al-Latifa, is his thoughtfulness regarding the communities in which he is working. He's the inventor of the idea, but then uses communities to actually think through what he's making and how it's produced. Indeed, El-Seed says he understands when making large-scale public art projects, it is essential to get into the mindset that you are working for those who live there, rather than creating whatever you'd like. You give this feeling of ownership to people, and that is what I love, he says. That was the entirety of the text, and there is a photograph here, mostly in black and white. It is artist El-Seed in his Dubai studio, February 17. He's sitting on a table, and it's brown wood plank, and that's the only non-black and white item in the room. Anyway, he's dressed in a black T-shirt and black trousers, perched on this table with his feet propped up on the seat of a black chair. And his feet are wearing shoes. They're like tennis shoes, walkers, but they're silvery gray with white, bright pink, and black designs on them. Behind him on a white wall is a black, what looks like maybe an embossed square canvas, but I don't know what the medium is, nor the support. And next to that is a black and white figurative piece of art. It, only part of it is shown in this photo, but it has the context of the Arabic calligraphy, although I think it's more stylized and differently composed than lines of calligraphy would be. The artist himself, El-Seed, is partly bald. He has a definite receding hairline. His hair is dark and very short, almost shaved. He has facial hair that is very neatly trimmed and is dark. He has dark eyes, and he's wearing dark-rimmed glasses, and he's looking right at the camera. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.